Hi, I'm Emily Booter, and you're listening to the No Film School podcast. Today, I'm speaking with prolific indie filmmaker Nathan Silver and the stars of his latest movie, Thirst Street, Lindsay Burge and Damien Bernard. And when I say prolific, I mean prolific. Silver has made a movie every single year for the past 8 years in a row. Last year, I interviewed him when he had the film Actor Martinez at the Tribeca Film Festival. Needless to say, Silver is a staple in the New York indie film scene. In our conversation, we discussed how Silver manages to get his micro-budget projects off the ground, some tips for shooting with limited resources, Thirst Street's distinctive 70s psychodrama aesthetic, and the extreme emotional risks some of the main actors had to take for their roles. Here's Silver, Burge, and Damien Bernard. So can you guys just start by introducing yourselves one by one so we can get familiar with your voices?
I'm Lindsay Burge, and I play Gina.
I'm Nathan Silver. I'm the director and co-writer.
I'm Damien Bernard, and I play Jerome and Paul.
You, both of you, you're drawn to pretty uncomfortable stories, stories that kind of provoke discomfort or, like, exist on the margins of social norms. So when you last worked together, it was Actor Martinez, right?
Yeah.
Okay, so in that situation, Lindsay was kind of thrust into a situation where you didn't know what was happening, and it turned out that you were being asked to play yourself in different situations that were also uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
So, Lindsay, why did you come back for more for the second time?
Well, in spite of how it may have seemed in Actor Martinez, I actually had a really, really good time making that movie. After I lost my mind and then recovered, I had, like, a great time. And I also really liked how it turned out. So I guess at that point I was kind of down for whatever Nathan had in mind. And when he said he was making a movie in Paris, that's fairly hard for me to resist because I do love Paris. So.
And Nathan, what about you? What draws you to this kind of material?
I mean, I can't say that I find life very comfortable, so I guess I make movies about the life that I live. I mean, it's not that bad. It's just like I feel like there's a certain discomfort in life, and you know, it's necessary to show that, but also make fun of it and make light of it, and you know, just show that it's a series of cosmic jokes. You know.
So, where did the idea for this particular film come from?
I wanted right after Actor Martinez, when I got back from Denver, I told Chris Wells, who I was writing all these scripts with, we were working on like three at the same time, that I wanted to work with Lindsay. I wanted to write something for her where she would be the lead. And he'd actually written a script for her where she goes to Paris, but I never saw this or anything. And the idea of Lindsay in Paris just made complete sense. So we took it from there, and we never looked at his initial script.
You've said this before, but how did you come up with the idea for the movie?
The idea for the movie, I guess the idea for the movie evolved over time. It was, you know, I'm trying to remember the impetus.
I don't remember it either.
It's odd because, you know, after you make the thing, you forget why
you made it.
Why you made it, which is great. But I guess that's unfortunate for interviews.
Because, Chris's mom was a flight attendant.
Yeah.
Who's Chris?
Chris is the co-writer and a producer. I suppose I wanted to make a movie about delusion and love, and we wanted like a Don Quixote-like tale, someone who bends reality. And it just so happened. And Chris and I were very interested in all of these movies from the 70s and 80s, these like French erotic thrillers and this sleazy feel, because we were watching them at the time, and as soon as we knew that it was going to take place in Paris, it made perfect sense to try and infuse some of the movie with that sleaze.
So you've called this a psychosexual thriller. Is that
black comedy?
Okay, you've changed your mind.
And I guess there are thriller aspects in there. It goes and it bounces in every direction, I say.
So how did you balance all of those tones while on set, and you too, Lindsay?
It basically was scene by scene. I say, like, some scenes we played out would play out more naturalistically than others. Some scenes would be hyper stylized, and so it was just we played it. You could say you played it scene by scene. I feel like if you think about the scene in the hospital where you have the blood, which is much more, which is ridiculous, or the scene in the party scene is much more of a naturalistic event, you know.
Right. I'm not sure that I thought about playing at different tones.
Yeah.
Like, I'm not sure that was really my job.
It was more about putting you in an environment.
Yeah, yeah. It was often just like, I don't know how. Yeah, I was just like going into the situation and trying to play just whatever Gina would sort of be doing in that zone. And then a lot of, I feel like, the tonal stuff was happening around me. And also certainly like the lighting, I think, like seeing how extreme the lighting was sometimes and things like that, I would be like, oh, okay, I guess this scene's going to be like that.
So when you first read the script, obviously Gina is a very extreme character. So how did you think about playing her in the most realistic manner possible?
Everything that she's doing is pretty extreme. So, but I guess it all had to be, it all was kind of had to sit on the foundation of just that she had decided that she was in love with this person. So, I mean, I think people act really crazy when they're in love. From my experience and also just from watching other people I know. It's like sometimes this movie, I think, even feels like melodrama occasionally.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah,
and
yeah.
But I mean, that's how I see people act. But so long as it was sort of rooted in like a real sort of feeling, I wasn't that, like, I knew that I was behaving in ways that were ridiculous or like freakish, and I was sort of just counting on them to take care of me and not let me look like too freaking crazy.
Yeah, I mean, it's about a damaged person who's recovering from, you know, who's recovering from a traumatic event. So watching her navigate that and try to stay grounded is what the movie is, you know. It's like, but her desperation, you know, is oozing out of her in every scene, you know.
Yeah, and the character isn't completely unrelatable. I mean, when I ran into you at the party the other night, Nathan, I was telling you that there are those flashes of recognition that happen,
right,
where there's something really organic and you suddenly see yourself in the character and you're like, holy shit, I can't believe I see myself in this person.
Yeah.
But that's the point.
Yeah. I mean, I feel like that, yeah, I mean, not everybody, but anybody who feels a lot probably has at least experienced some degree of that kind of desperation if they let themselves, you know, if they let themselves.
I mean, it's like you decide to, it's not that we just fall in love and it works out. You decide to make love work. And if both parties aren't working together, then that's where this kind of miscommunication, insanity can, you know, can start to develop, where one party, it can go off the rails because of what the other party does. I mean, love is crazy.
It is.
No, I mean, it's not like, when two people connect and they get along and love works, it's no more sane. I mean, I don't see it as more sane than when one person's in love with someone where it's unrequited, you know? It's the same, it's just that it's unrequited, it's unfortunate.
Yeah.
So I'm fascinated by that, and also like what makes us this need to love and this need to have a reason. I mean, outside of love, Gina's character, she's a flight attendant, she has her job, she has nothing to talk about. It's like me with filmmaking. I have nothing to talk about outside of filmmaking, you know what I mean? And so I look for love because I'd love to love. Like, it gives you something to do. It's like you have work and then you have love.
Right.
I feel like life is
it's like a purpose.
A
right.
Purpose, exactly.
Also, I feel like when I was younger, I used to, like, considerably younger, I used to say that I didn't believe in unrequited love. I was like, there's no such thing as unrequited love. Like, if you love somebody, then they must love you back, which I think I've fortunately outgrown that concept because it's not true. But but I think I feel like Gina has had a bit of that feeling where she's just like, well, I love him, so therefore he must love me. It's just it has to be. There's no other way. Which is sad and foolish.
And of course, and Jerome's character is reacting, is it doesn't want to hurt her. I mean, that's the whole thing. There's a weakness in him where he can't just push her out of his life and say that it's over, because there's some sensitivity to him. He's not simply, you know, I mean, he's a weak character. And so it's unfortunate for him. I mean, obviously it results in, it has bad results for him. It has bad results for him, good results for Gina.
But at the time, you know, you can see him as being cruel for not putting her out of her misery and telling her like it is, or you can see him as having some sort of mercy and not humiliating her every single opportunity mm-hmm. he has the chance to. Mm-hmm. So that's what I loved about his character. You can have compassion for him.
He's mm-hmm. indecisive, which yeah. is a lot of the people I know can relate to that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, especially in New York.
Yes. Where you lead people on and then you don't realize that that's more cruel than simply saying, no, please leave me alone.
Right. Forever, please.
Yes.
But that would be so sad and harsh to do to somebody like Gina.
Yeah.
And I mean, and Gina's character, too, is someone who's in love with movies, like, or old romantic movies, musicals. It says, I mean, that's what the narration states. That's what stated in the voiceover. It's her character. She believes in love. She's a romantic, you know?
Right. And like in movies and especially those movies, we've been told that, you know, if you fall in love and then you get the person and then you live happily ever after. And so she's just like, that's what's supposed to happen.
Yeah. Yeah, and so there's this old-fashioned sense to her character. And obviously she wants things that not necessarily are in vogue nowadays, like a family and...
Well, families are in vogue, Nathan. You just don't know about it because you live in New York.
Well, that's a thing. And I'm surrounded
very
by,
true. Yeah, no. They're incredibly in vogue.
They're in vogue in other places, I suppose. But it seems like there's a shift now to...
Well, totally.
And,
sure.
You know, people like Gina, I feel like, are closer to my mother's generation than this generation.
Yes.
Well, you brought so much of that romantic sheen and the aesthetic to the film itself, and... That was surprising for me because I'm familiar with your work and you haven't done something like that before, a very stylized film. So how did you build together all the stylistic elements in pre-production and during production?
That was just inherent to the treatment that we had. I knew that I wanted certain kinds of lighting. I knew that with Sean, we wanted to create this, like this cinema du look, like from the like 80s French cinema, like this neon weird hell in Paris. And I also knew that I wanted to return to lush melodramas. I wanted to have to put it outside. I don't want it to feel like it takes place now, because what's fascinating to me is that there's this whole return to, you know, like obviously we shot before Trump was elected, but there's this idea of like America in the 50s again, you know, that we should make America like it was before, which is kind of crazy. And that's when Cirque was making his splashy melodramas, so there's some connection there. Unconscious, I think it is, because I wasn't thinking about that at all when I was shooting the movie or in pre-production, but I was, every night before I was going to bed, I was listening to MSNBC, which I never do here, but I would have it on in the background, and I was listening to all of their coverage of the conventions and all that stuff, and I think that started to sink in that, like, there's this need, there's a whole... part of this country that wants to return to this, you know, like to the musicals and the kind of junk that Gina was, you know, Gina's character was watching is into. So that came to me afterwards, though. So maybe that was the impulse to make this.
That's really interesting to hear, because that is a pipe dream. And a lot of what your movie is a woman wrestling with a pipe dream.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So it's interesting to hear the political undertones.
Well, it's just odd because, I mean, it's strange that people would want that after so much progress. Then there's this, you know, obviously there's always opposition, but now it's taking over. And this idea, and across Europe too, you know, nationalism.
Yeah.
So it's kind of a funny thing.
How did you decide to shoot in Paris?
I had met Claire, one of the producers on the film, at a festival a few years ago, and so I'd been we were working on a script together, and I'd been going back and forth between New York and Paris a bunch, and I knew I wanted to. I'd made all these French connections, and I'm a Francophile. I became obsessed with French poetry when I was a teenager, and then I went and lived there when I was 15, then again when I was 25, and so I always had wanted to make something there. And Chris, when he said he had a script where Lindsay was in Paris, I was like, oh, well, this is perfect.
Going back to those stylistic elements, what were some of the lighting setups or specific camera movements that you really thought were endemic to this style?
So basically, we knew that we wanted expressionistic lighting. We knew how we wanted the movie to feel. We used smoke machines. We used sometimes there was pantyhose on the lens. There was Sean always puts nose grease on the filters.
Oh, that's awesome.
Yeah. But
that gave it kind of the gauzy look.
Exactly.
Yeah.
So we knew that we wanted that. And then it was basically each scene dictated what the camera was doing, where the camera was. And with anamorphic lenses and the fact that you have that, you know, its scope, it creates this wider space. And so that dictated the blocking of the actors.
And you also had an aspect ratio that was unique, right?
Yeah, because our DIT messed it up on the first day over in France, and so we decided that it was going to be intentional.
So what did you want?
True?
Yes.
Wow, I didn't know.
So from
that
there on out, it wasn't. It's not that he messed it up. He put on. He basically, yes, he messed it up, and so then so then we were like, well, we'll just go with this, and this will be the third aspect.
That's what was the aspect ratio?
I'm gonna get it wrong. It's wider than scope.
235:1. Does that sound right?
It's wider than that.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Okay.
I believe so.
Huh.
So it's a new aspect ratio.
They reinvented.
Yeah, we reinvented the aspect ratio. So it's slightly wider than scope.
Speaking of reinventing, on a lot of your films, you've wanted to do improvisation, and I know that, Lindsay, you like working in that manner, and I'm sure you do. So was the approach to this film as less structured than it was on your previous ones, or more structured, and how were you able to do rewrites on set?
I mean, it was certainly more structured than my last few movies. It was the outline was 27 pages long instead of two, like we had for Actor Martinez.
Yeah, we definitely knew like what was supposed to happen in every scene, which I think is different than how you sometimes work. But we didn't know what we were gonna exactly say or anything like that. It was actually kind of interesting because it was so much more stylistically specific, and technically specific. It was this interesting combination for me, at least a unique combination of. Okay, so you need to hit this mark, and then you need to be sort of facing this way and doing this thing, but then we don't know what you're going to say. Yeah. So it was like, normally when you're improvising like that, there's this sort of style often of like, you have all this freedom, and you can move around, you can do whatever, but this was like this weird thing where we were confined in these sort of traditional cinematic ways, but then had to still do the sort of like loosey-goosey coming up with our own dialogue and stuff like that.
So it's like controlled improv.
Totally.
Yeah.
But the most controlled that I've ever done, probably, improv. Yeah. And then also simultaneously you're acting with other people who don't speak the same language as you. So you're often improvising in another language that you don't speak, which is really unique.
Yeah. Et pour toi, Damien, c'était comment jouer son scénario complet?
For me, it's perfect for many reasons, because your script is really, we don't have dialogue, but it's very precise and très cadré. Je sais pas comment dire.
Framed, very like, there's a framework there.
Yeah, and before we make the movie, we have many, many, many discussions.
About the character.
Every day, about the character and, and the past and what they have, what they want, many, many things. And it's after when we shoot, you can just express that, I think.
Express that.
Express that.
Mm-hmm.
It's perfect. Right.
Yeah. I mean, and Damien is very particular about what I like about him. He's very particular about props. He loved to have certain props on him. Without them, like, you always had the clay. Yeah. Like, you had to have these certain things and his cigarettes. And it was very beautiful to see that. It helped. Like, he had this. Once we developed the character, Damien, like, he knew who Jerome was and what he would have on him at any given time. And it was really lovely to see.
And Jerome's character, for me, it's my first movie in English. But it's a real pleasure because Jérôme is like a man qui pourrait sauter d'un avion.
Throw himself in an airplane.
Sauter d'un avion.
He would jump out of an airplane.
Mais sans parachute.
Yeah,
without a parachute.
Pour atterrir dans un autre avion.
I mean, Gina basically does that.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And I think that's like why it's so believable that she would be so drawn to him also, mm-hmm. because he just exudes that sort of quality that she is in this almost more extreme manner, actually.
Yeah. He's also, what's wonderful about him is his indifference to, it's like, okay, I will accept this situation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Whatever situation the character's in, he accepts and then tries to, you know, he's cool.
Yeah.
He never freaks out, really, except for maybe one or twice.
Time. Yeah.
At the same time, I think the characters of Gina, it's like a mirror for me about love and my love with Clémence and all the love Gina have for me. And the same, I don't want this love, but I see I lost my love with Clémence, I think.
Yeah, you recognize that same. Yeah.
And it's when I cry to her, I think I cry to me, you know?
When you scream.
When I scream to her, I scream for me.
What do you think was one of the hardest scenes to shoot from an emotional and a practical level?
There are two scenes that come to mind for me.
That's interesting. Why don't you go first? And then
well, the hardest scene was that one in the club. Just because there were a lot of people.
Yeah.
There were a lot of people in the scene. It was kind of supposed to be an emotionally heightened scene to some extent, and there were just so many people to be communicated with.
Yes.
And that one was just really extreme. And actually, we wound up changing the scene quite a bit just because it was like there were too many moving parts, too many people, and it wasn't going to come out the way it had been intended. So you very smartly, you know, we went to lunch. Eventually, I was like, we went to lunch, regrouped, and like conceived of a new way to do the scene that worked well.
Yes.
And then I have another scene, but you should say what yours is.
I mean, there are certain scenes where I think the hardest scenes were the ones where there was no plot that had to be. It was just a matter of like small.
Oh.
I mean, there were, but I don't really want to get into that because it's just when you shoot improvisation, it can sometimes be extremely frustrating for the actors involved because it feels like it's not going anywhere. But I know, like, I knew at the time that I needed those scenes, and so I think some people were frustrated by the content. But then when we edited it down, it worked really well.
Right.
So it was just like the feeling on set wasn't exactly like jubilation after we finished those scenes. But that's always the case on sets. I've had that happen because I've shot many improvised movies. I guess technically speaking, the hardest scene to shoot was, it's odd, you know, I would agree with Lindsay that the scene in the club, and I forgot about this, I mean, that was the scene where I was like, I felt like we were losing everyone.
Yeah.
And it turned into an 18-hour day, and it was just, you know, it was not one of those days where it was, luckily the next day was off, but it was one of those days where everyone was about to kill me.
How do you navigate those days as a director, like in terms of morale?
I don't know. I don't know that you necessarily navigate them. You try and apologize as best you can and try and, you know, make it up to people by not repeating that kind of, it was a necessary thing that happened though, and it changed. It basically, the intention of the in the script was wrong. the intention of the scene, of some of the characters, their intentions were off, so it had to be rewritten. And that just became evident as we tried again and again to get it right. And there were a lot of extras, and there, like Lindsay was saying, and it was a lot of, there were a lot of moving pieces. And it was, I believe that was the first day in the club, first or second day.
I don't think it was the first.
But was it one of the early days
maybe
in the club.
Day, yeah. But also, if you imagine the all the communication that has to go on between all the different departments, especially if you're changing something in a big way, and, you know, in addition to that, the majority of the people don't speak the same language as the director and like the main actor and the DP. So there's just like so much communication that has to be done.
Yeah.
So many opportunities for misunderstandings and things like that. So whatever kind of feeling of chaos ensues on an ordinary set was kind of duplicated because of that.
Oh, yeah. It was amplified. It was, you know.
Yeah. And you throw in a foreign language to the mix.
Yeah,
exactly.
It's even worse.
So you can just imagine how. And, you know, it's like right before lunch, everyone's cranky and hot. Yeah. So hot. It was so hot in Paris right then.
Yeah. And the air conditioning couldn't be on for sound, obviously. And
yeah.
Yeah. I mean, it was great.
That was the one scene, though, that stands out in my mind.
Yeah. No, I guess that's very true. I mean, the other things were pretty standard frustrations. The last day on set, I had food poisoning and was feverish and
that's awful.
In the bathroom most of the day.
Yeah, he couldn't actually, like, he basically couldn't speak for the last day that we shot, which was a lot of kind of important scenes.
Yeah, and I was, but what's weird is that, I mean, a lot of those scenes are delirious scenes and shot.
Perfect.
It was kind of perfect.
Yeah, there is this like fever dream aspect to the film. So
I was just like absorbing Nathan's energy. I was like, okay.
That made no sense and I'm going with it.
Et moi, je dormais pour de vrai dans le coma.
Ouais.
And I sleep from the real.
You slept for real.
You
fell asleep for real.
In a coma.
And our DP was late. It was one of those days, and we were now outside of Paris. It was one of those days where it was just like, oh, this is like gonna be. If we don't get all this stuff, we're fucked.
Yeah, it's totally a nightmare. Yeah.
But we got it, and then I just I actually had to they had to extend my stay in Paris because I was so sick, and then I flew back and immediately hopped in a car to go to upstate New York for the U.S. portion of the shoot.
Oh, my God. Well, this is kind of, I remember you guys told me that shooting actor Martinez felt like you were on LSD. So it's kind of like within the ethos of your filmmaking style.
Yeah, I've come to expect a certain level of insanity from a Nathan Silver picture.
Yeah. I believe for you, Lindsay, for Damian, and you can tell me if you're wrong. It was this paradise.
Yeah.
It was really a lovely time. C'était un paradis. Oh,
yeah. It was very special. It became very first I was miserable, but then it became incredibly special.
Yeah. And
I hated to leave Paris.
I know.
So
no
sad.
One wanted to leave. It was this odd thing where everyone was trying to miss their flight home.
That's amazing. And,
but you know, it was funny because I look at this pocket of time. It was a very beautiful period of time. And you watch the movie, it might not be the most, it might not be the happiest movie, but I think it's infused with some kind of paradise fever dream quality that was actually on set.
Yeah, it was very real.
At what point did Angelica Houston's narration come into the picture? Was that always the plan to have a narrator?
It was always the plan to have narration in the movie because Chris and I knew that we wanted it to be a perverse fairy tale like this. We wanted to establish it as a tale. We didn't know what that was going to be, and we wanted to wait till we had a cut to see. And then once we had a cut and we started writing the narration, we talked to our producers in the U.S., Katie and Josh Blum at Washington Square, and Katie said, oh, Angelica Houston should do this. I was like, oh my God, you're right. She played a lovesick flight attendant in Crimes and Misdemeanors, and her voice is, you know, iconic.
Perfect.
It's just like absolutely ideal. And so Josh Blum had just worked with her on something. He sent her a DVD of the movie with some temp narration in there, and she watched it over Christmas, and she loved it. She loved Lindsay's performance. She said that it's rare to see someone play a, you know, not an insane woman, but a damaged woman and do it so well to really pull that off.
That's true.
And so, and then she did it and she killed it. I went to LA and recorded her and it took a half hour. I was amazed. It was like, it just flew by.
That's incredible.
Yeah. She got it. And she said something extremely just that made perfect sense to me. She said, "I after watching your movie, I knew that I would add something to it." And she didn't mean like publicity wise or, you know, her name. She meant that she did this movie because she knew that she was right for it. Which I think it was like, oh, that makes sense. You do something where you actually think you're right for it.
Yeah.
But to actually hear that said by someone, I was like, oh, wow. You know, that's very intelligent and simple and makes sense. And I wish I want to, you know, that's a lovely thing. So I'm very grateful that she did it. When I found out, I was actually getting drinks with my co-writer in a really bad place after bad holidays. And I was like, you know, in the dumps, and I got a message, and it's like, Angelica's doing it. And I started crying. I was like, oh, God.
Oh, that's so sweet.
That is so sweet.
I hope you told her that.
I don't believe I did.
That would maybe be a little embarrassing to admit to her. I met her like for 1 second, and then I just like ran out of the room because I was so shy.
She went on, she talked to me about Lindsay for 10 minutes after Lindsay left. She loved
that. That's
loved
so nice. Lindsay. I mean, aww. I love her, so I was just like, I gotta go. I can't be here.
Everyone's dreams got fulfilled.
Yeah.
When Angelica Houston comes into
You should have seen it when she walked in the room. It's like she's larger than life. I mean, she's just so like she's glowing.
I know. It's a kind of human. You're like, all right, there are good people do like exist. Like there's like this.
Yeah.
It's very strange.
It gives you some kind of like hope about it all.
I know. Yeah, it's like there is some integrity in Hollywood, I guess.
Yeah, that's exactly it. It's like you see somebody like her and you're like, oh, right. It's not all the way you worry that it is. You know, some people there are really good.
Yes.
And there's a reason why they're there.
Yeah. Those moments for me are always really important, but you tend to overemphasize them because you're like, there's one amazing person out of 100,000, you know?
Yeah. But I guess that's better than zero.
But it gets to be, you know, I live in LA now, and I just want to, just for the record, it gets to be more. It's like you start to meet more and more people, and you realize that, and they kind of stick together, and like, there's good people there too.
Okay, good. So, Nathan, I actually didn't realize this until I was looking at doing research for the film earlier, but I realized that you've made 8 movies in 8 years, which is kind of crazy.
Yeah, and I think it's made me a little crazy. I say to myself, I want to slow down, but I don't think that's happening because I'm shooting a documentary in May and then I'm shooting a series in June. So, and I'm writing 2 scripts. So I think that it's probably, I have a mania to work because it's the only thing that, you know, when I'm doing a production, I actually feel like a human. I don't need Valium. I don't need other. I feel good. I'm around people I love. I'm around, you know, it's how life should be. And then, of course, you go into postpartum depression. But whatever. It's production I look forward to. Pre-production is always very stressful. And production is stressful in its own way, but it's the kind of stress I love. So I guess I crave it. I need it. I'm addicted to it. But I want to make bigger things. I'm tired of making no money off of these. And I think that I want to have larger crews. I want to be able to have lusher environments. I want to be able to do more elaborate camera setups. I just want to make bigger movies. I want to make, you know, I want to work on a bigger scale.
That makes sense. I mean, a lot of these, you probably had to throw them together more quickly than you would have wanted to because the money came in and, you know, you had certain things in place.
We shot this in 15 days.
Wow. That is, that's nuts. But how do you, like, in the past, how have you finished a movie and then immediately been able to just get up and do another one?
Because as soon as I finish a movie, I already have the next one. I've started pre-production. I start pre-production during post-production.
Wow, you have a lot going on at once.
Yeah, I mean, so right now we're in post-production on another movie that I shot right beforehand. They co-directed with Jack Dunphy in May in Chicago, and we're tweaking the edit. That's much more of a documentary. It's like 90% documentary and 10% fiction.
Do you think that each of these films that you've made have built on each other to create almost like an easier start for the next film?
Yes, certainly. I mean, we'll see to get to the next, you know, next level, I need more money and I know about, I need to have a script. I mean, I'm going to write dialogue for the next few projects. I've had enough of improvisation for the moment. I mean, I of course there'll be improvisation here and there, but I need to have the dialogue written out. I'm interested in getting, I don't know. You get bored with the way you work at times and you want to work against yourself and you want to find a new in.
You want to challenge yourself.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So.
And how do each of you feel like you want to challenge yourselves in the future?
Qu'est-ce que tu veux faire avec tes films?
Non, moi j'aime bien tout aller partout.
You want to work on a lot of things.
Yeah.
And that's what's great. I mean,
yeah.
With directors, you like to work with, you choose a director that you get along with. Tu choisis le réalisateur que tu préfères et puis...
Ou ils me choisissent eux, ouais.
Oui.
C'est des histoires surtout qui m'intéressent, moi.
Oui.
Tu veux traduire? Ou...
Oui, so it's the stories that interest him. And he...
Et art, et l'art, enfin, les histoires et les choses artistiques, enfin... comme l'image de ton film, comme la mise en scène, tout ça, je sais pas.
It's what, you know, it's the art of the films that he's working on. That's what interests him. And I guess it's not necessarily, I think right now for him, it's not necessarily about challenging himself, but finding, you know, people that he loves to collaborate with.
That's the challenge.
That is the challenge.
Yeah.
That is the challenge.
Courir vers l'inconnu.
Yeah, he wants to run into the unknown. He was looking for things that...
thing I've ever
he's
heard.
He's just the most French person that there is.
But I always see... What I see in him, though, is someone... I mean, all of our American friends are pretty obsessed with him. They just think that he's like this classic kind of... Like, Buñuel would have cast him, you know? He's this face, this presence who's kind of... we feel like he'll be remembered in France.
We like the same things, you know, the same movie, same literature. I like working with people
like-minded people with similar spirits.
Yeah, heads. And we can create together and like a new person. I don't know, but it's a movie. Yeah.
Exactly. Like, yeah, we have a baby together.
Yeah.
Perfect.
He said something beautiful the other day. He said, hangovers are the children of drunkenness.
The unruly children.
Uh-huh. What about you, Lindsay?
How do I want to challenge myself? Well, I mean, I love working this way. It's like a, you know, it's a crazy way of working, and I do love it. And it's like going... like willing, like allowing yourself to go insane and every single time and then having to recover and do it again and again. But I also, it does appeal to me to also work in a larger scale, like in a, you know, more traditional form, just because I haven't done as much of that. And it's so different. It's just really different. It feels, you know, totally different on set. And I feel like it's a really different way of working that I would like to be more acquainted with. But unfortunately, it's still, like, I just only want to work on things that I think are really good and weird. And I have weird tastes, so.
So you're going to find that in these kinds of movies, yeah.
Yeah, I mean, it's out there, you know? Like, there's good stuff being made, too, on different scales, and I think it would be fun to try my hand at that a bit. I also want to do comedy. Like I do like comedy, and I'm not like a, you know, I'm not a comedian or like whatever, but I definitely think, especially with a script, it's like I do like a script. and I think that would be really fun for me next.
Yeah.
Looking back on this experience, I mean, it wasn't that long ago, was it?
No.
No, but it feels like a long time ago, which is odd. Because the year's been torn apart by all sorts of
political. There's been all kinds of things.
It's become like AD and AC for five different events.
Yeah. So it's a strange period right now.
Yeah. But what do you think that you each gained from this project that you may not have gained from previous projects? In terms of a learning, something you learned
I was happy to be able to put together something for a relatively low budget that I think feels like it wasn't, you know, it's not scrappy. It feels like a movie. So that heartens me. I don't know if I learned anything, if that means that I learned anything, but just it means that I feel like I can move forward and continue this. I feel much more comfortable working with the actors. I feel much more comfortable with the camera, like working with like Sean, the DP. We were very much in line with each other. But that's just after, I guess, after you make a bunch of movies, you start to feel
like hit your stride.
Yeah. Of course, there are always going to be times where it's difficult. There are some people where you realize you can't direct them. And that happens. But you make it work and in the edit. It's not that you can't direct them, but you just don't know what to do with the situation at hand. But I think that that's just part of the job, as Arthur would say.
Arthur.
You miss him?
Yeah, miss the guy.
It's hard to think of what you learned particularly from one thing. I feel like this one maybe for me was like a bit of, I had to like learn how to let go a little bit of control, maybe more than I have in some other projects. I think other times I've felt like I could have as much control as I wanted to have, and there was room for that. But in this one, there were so many people who were involved who it felt very collaborative. It felt like all of the elements were really important instead of it, you know? And so it was like I got to let go a little bit more and just kind of like do what I could and like trust and hope and pray that everybody else was gonna, you know, also do what they could. And I didn't feel like I was solely responsible for the film, you know, being what it was or whatever.
That makes sense. It didn't rest all on your shoulders.
Yeah, exactly. Like I knew that they were doing so much with the look of it and that was going to continue with the sound and everything, that all the elements were going to be really important.
Well, they all come together really nicely. This was awesome. I think it's actually your best film, Nathan.
Oh, thank you.
Have you heard that yet?
Yes, yeah.
Oh, you have?
Yeah.
Good. It's a consensus.
Yeah, it's a consensus. Et Damien, qu'est-ce que tu gagnes de ce film?
You... Nathan and
oh,
Lindsay,
all so
the
sweet.
Crew,
yeah.
And a beautiful movie, a very beautiful, very, very, very beautiful movie. And j'ai gagné beaucoup, much liberty.
Freedom.
Freedom, yeah.
Yeah, you always were talking about you loved the freedom of it.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Freedom. Yeah. Freedom, equality, fraternity.
Huh? I was just thinking.
I was saying equality, liberty, fraternity.
Freedom and art.
Façon française.
Freedom and art.
Freedom and art. Hopefully those are the only things that we have to cling on to. Freedom
yeah.
and art.
Especially if you move forward into bigger budget things. Never lose those two.
Yeah.
Freedom and art.
Right. Right, but less freedom. There's always going to be less freedom, I think.
Yeah. That's
something
true.
Bigger. Yeah.
You got to fight for it.
Yeah.
As long as there's some art to it.
But that's fun too. That's what I'm saying. It's like there's some like appeal to being like, no, we actually need you to do this thing, and we need you to do it this way, and we need you to do it now.
Yeah. Absolutely. Yeah.
And you get to kind of inject your own
and
quirkiness into it.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's
fun.
Well, thank you guys so much joining me today.
Of course.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you for listening. If you liked what you heard today, please do us a grand old favor and subscribe and rate us on iTunes. See you Thursday for Indie Film Weekly.